So this talk adds another couple of examples to fitness landscapes. They are of a slightly different nature, and I haven't yet decided whether I should be optimistic or pessimistic about what they say about how complex populations move on these fitness landscapes. So this is the topic of my talk, so I will focus on how different population, distinguished by population size and mutation rate, move on fitness landscape that are rather similar in nature. So let me start by thanking the people with whom I did the work. I will report on two case studies. One is fitness landscape for microRNA processing. This is the more recent work, and I want to spend most of the time of the talk discussing that. This is Ralf Bunschuh, who spent a sabbatical in Cologne, and Juliette de Meaux, who is a plant biologist and population geneticist. She's going to come later to this program, is now in Münster. And the work on fitness landscape for transcription factor binding sites was done together with Ville Mustonen, who's also going to join us in a couple of weeks here, and the Princeton group of Kurt Callen. So let me start with the fitness landscapes for cis-regulatory elements. I want to be very brief on this because this has been out for a while and have talked already about this. And then we want to contrast this with the second part, where fitness landscapes of microRNA processing. As we'll see, the fitness landscape for the two types of processes are rather similar in nature, but the dynamics on them differs. And it differs exactly because the parameters of population size and mutation rate between the populations differ between the two cases. So here's my very brief introduction into the first kind of fitness landscape for cis-regulatory elements. So I look specifically at cases where the binding is like in lower eukaryotes or prokaryotes, where single binding sites and the binding of transcription factor has a regulatory function. In this case, we have two things that make this problem attractive in the framework of this discussion that we had on fitness landscapes. On the one hand, we have a relatively compact sequence space. It's of the order of 10 nucleotides that can take 4 states. And usually, we have a good statistics, at least of the genomic usage of these characters in a genome by what is called a position weight matrix. That is an approximate description of this genomic usage, because it counts single nucleotide frequencies at these position and doesn't take into account correlations, but still, so we have something. And secondly, we have a molecular phenotype, namely the binding energy, that summarizes everything that this little sequence, or presumably most of the stuff that each little sequence contributes to function and fitness. So we take the binding energy as a molecular phenotype for these binding sites. And the thing that we have thirdly, and that distinguishes this first case from our second case, is that in the populations we look at, the binding sites are typically monomorphic. So the product of mutation rate and population size and the relevant genomic length, in this case of order 10, is still smaller than 1. And in this case, we can at least say one thing relatively straightforwardly, that if we have an evolutionary equilibrium in processes of mutation, selection, and drift, no matter what the fitness landscape on this genomic space is, it's essentially a Boltzmann distribution. It is the neutral distribution on this space multiplied by a simple exponential of the fitness times the effective population size. And so this is exactly, this becomes exact in the limit of mu n much smaller than 1. And you note that in this expression of the equilibrium, the mutation rate drops out. So, of course, mutations are still important in getting us from one space on this fitness landscape to the next one. We couldn't do this without mutation, but they are merely triggering this dynamics. The equilibrium is only determined by the balance between drift and selection. It's only the tempo by which we move on this landscape.
Well, there's drift mutation balance in the P0.
Sorry?
Isn't there a drift mutation balance in your P0 in this neutral population ensemble?
Right, but in this, that's true. But in the Boltzmann factor, that drops out. So, what this means, this is a regime where we can imagine populations mostly hopping as points in sequence space. Now here, we don't have a strongly driven adaptive process like in clonal interference. We more move up and down close to maxima of this fitness landscape, so we imagine an equilibrium process, but we can still, it's an example of the first kind where where populations hop as points on these fitness landscapes. And what this means is that in this regime, the probability of a genotype, this exponential factor, depends only on its fitness. And it no point, so 2 points of this on this fitness landscape that have the same fitness will have the same probability of being touched by a population over its course in time, irrespective of the neighborhood of these points. So fitness landscape are sampled point-wise, and we can immediately project, and this is maybe the second theme of this talk, what can we learn now from projecting these genotype fitness maps to phenotype fitness maps. In this case, we can project this whole fitness landscape onto a phenotype fitness map, and the probability of observing a given phenotype, in this case the binding energy, depends only on the value of that phenotype.
But Richard said that in the neutral distribution, the mutation rates enter, right? So when you compare 2 points.
Right, I mean, so that's true.
Then their distribution, their occupancy not only depends on the fitness, but also somehow on the mutation rates.
This is true. Now, if let's for a moment think that mutations are, that all mutation rates are the same. But you're right. So my comments are like on this exponential Boltzmann factor. And then there is the underlying neutral distribution that may or may not be more or less complicated, depending on how complicated this neutral mutation process is. This is also the question whether this process generates curls
right,
in addition to fitness or not.
The other thing that I think is that the independence on the neighborhood structure, I mean, the time scale for equilibrating does depend very much on this neighborhood structure, right? So that if you have peaks with some maybe valleys between, it might be that, you know, on no reasonable time scale will you ever equilibrate in the next year.
Yeah. Right? That's completely true. And so that's why in this example, and this is sort of an example where it's an easy fitness landscape. I think if it gets very complicated, then this whole notion of equilibrium becomes very questionable. Now, in this case, it turns out to be an easy landscape. And so using this projection on this phenotype, because it's essentially a fitness landscape as a function of this quantitative trait, it turns out to be rather easy, and it turns out to be of the form, as we have seen several times this and last week. So when we now use the formula, and just we somehow have an ensemble of phenotypes that we get from under selection, and we compare this with an ensemble which is not under selection, and we just take the ratio of these two distributions as a function of E, and we take a log, we get an estimate of the fitness landscape. So one approximate way by which we have been doing this all along is to look in the genome we look at the family of transcription factor binding sites for one of these transcription factors. And so we look at, we take the position weight matrix, or any formula for the energy as a function of the sequence that you like. We screen over the intergenic regions of a genome. We get a distribution of this phenotype over non-sites, and we get a distribution over sites. And I skip all the subtleties in deciding what is a site and what is not a site for the moment. And then we take the ratio of these distributions, and what we get is a kind of, if you like, annealed approximation to this problem that takes all the, it ignores the differences between different instances of the site. And so you get a kind of genome average of the fitness landscape. And it what it looks like is a moderate fitness cliff. So this means just on average, if we increase the binding strength of a site, we get a higher fitness. So it's a moderate fitness cliff. By moderate, I mean that genetic drift can get us a finite way down from the plateau towards less fit region. One can even escape this by mutations and genetic drift. One can lose a binding site.
But this way of looking at it assumes that all the positions in the genome would really like to be binding targets for this transcription factor. So they have the ultimate fitness goal when they have a perfect consensus and the strongest binding energy. And the only thing which prevents them from ever getting to this peak is that, you know, this balance between climbing up the fitness landscape and mutating away. But the way, you know, I always think about those binding sites is that there is a function, there is a transcription factor which needs to regulate certain targets. And it may be that not all of them have to be very strong binders. It may be functionally relevant for this site.
Well, yeah, that's what I said. So it's not so that everybody likes to be, so this Q ensemble is evaluated over a set of binding sites, say a set of experimentally verified binding sites. So these are, of course, a subset. It's still true what you said, and this is just what I meant by my comment of this like genomic average, that what we ignore here is the site-to-site differences. For the sake of this analysis, we throw them all in one bag and say sites versus non-sites, and we have a common fitness landscape. So the question is whether this kind of approximation gives you anything reasonable, if it's predictive in any sense.
But even for true sites, there may be a functional reason why some of the sites are strong binders and other are weak binders, like, for instance,
of course,
certain temporal profile and certain information of transcription factors. You turn on this set of targets. As you increase it, you add to this another.
Right. You may think of this thing here as the superposition of some fitness landscapes for individual sites, which may also have a maximum somewhere at some intermediate binding. So, but despite the shortcomings of this inference, you get something out that you can test against evolutionary observables. So one thing you can test is the cross-species evolution of this phenotype. So you can simulate the evolution in this fitness landscape by mutation, genetic drift, and substitution rates that are coming now with a higher substitution rate for uphill moves and a lower substitution rate for downhill moves by standard population genetics. And you can compare this, so the, for example, the distribution of the phenotype divergence over a certain evolutionary distance with what you find in genomic data. So this is here between two different yeast species for one type, for one family of transcription factor binding sites, very pleiotropic transcription factor, ABF1. And you see here the theory is one line, and the observed differences for sites that do not overlap with other sites is in remarkable agreement with this prediction. Then there is a second family where sites are overlapped, and they, of course, they should not match this prediction, and they do not. You can also test this against polymorphism data. So when you look at polymorphisms within sites, then you see something like a distribution that is skewed towards negative values. That means most polymorphisms, they represent, they are low frequency polymorphisms. So they represent the distribution of selection coefficients of mutations. They have on average a negative selection coefficient. This means because in most binding sites, most letters are at their fitter state, a random mutation will on average have a negative fitness effect. So this distribution has a negative average, whereas the substitutions between two species, they are perfectly in detail balanced. So they have a perfectly symmetric distribution as required by our assumption of equilibrium. So far so good. So this was an example where populations move point-like. And now I want to contrast this with another example that the derivation of the fitness landscape is pretty similar, but the population that move in these fitness landscapes are different. So this is microRNA processing, and it's a mechanism that converts a pre-microRNA into a mature microRNA, and it's this study is in plants, and so there is presumably a universal mechanism that depends on properties of this pre-microRNA, and in particular it depends on that the pre-microRNA fold has in its secondary structure a stem. The pre-microRNA is transcribed, and then the processing machinery recognizes this extended stem, cuts the pre-microRNA, and then produces the mature microRNA. And I skip all the complex biology of this process. We're merely going to focus on the characteristics of this stem and how important it is for this folding mechanism. So the reason why we picked this is that what came up in your question, it's maybe even less of an issue here. So putting all the 130 microRNAs, or pre-microRNAs of Arabidopsis thaliana, into one statistical bucket and making one fitness landscape for this function is maybe less questionable here than it was for transcription factor binding sites, because this mechanism is presumably the same. Now, of course, each of these pre-microRNAs and the resultant microRNA has other functions. They have biological function, but they are quite diverse. But this processing step is the same, so we want to make a fitness landscape for that. Now,
one can always, I mean, there is some evidence, right, that there is relative, the rates of processing of different microRNAs are not the same, and people wave their hands and say it's meaningful or something.
It's completely true. I mean, but in some sense, this is true for any inference of selection, right? When we look at some class of molecules and we do synonymous sites versus non-synonymous and so on, we always form categories, and we always, in forming categories, we ignore the differences within one category and so on. So this comment is always there. I would argue that this, in this example, it's maybe more justified than in many other examples that we form this category. But of course, the more we discover about these things, the more we discover differences. And it may just as well suffer from the same sort of intra-category variation than the other examples as well. No, so let's see.
I would be happy to argue that ABF1 sites all experience one pressure.
So the question is, do we get anything predictive out? So I think this, in the end, whether this assumption is reasonable, we see a little bit in discussing the results. So we can do pretty much the same game. We look at the distribution of these stem lengths in these 130 real microRNAs. This is what is P plotted here in blue. And what we use here as phenotype is fairly straightforward. It's the free energy, the folding, the contribution of the folding free energy of this stem. In first approximation, you can think of this as something that is pretty proportional to the length. So, and a rule of thumb is that you have to divide this by 2 in order to get the length. So when you read here 20, it's stems that are typically 10 base pairs long. Depends a little bit. Some of them have small bubbles in them. And we have a rule to count, like when we have a small bubble that we still call this part of the stem, and then from some bigger bubble size, we call this the end of the stem. And then you can ask the question whether it's robust under this definition of what is a stem. But let me not go into these bioinformatic details. We made a couple of hopefully reasonable choices for them. And so we get a distribution of these stems in the actual 130 real microRNAs. And we contrast this with the distribution in a hopefully well-chosen null ensemble, which where we took other RNA sequences in Taliana, which are however not microRNAs. So we have sort of still all the base, nucleotide frequencies of RNA coding sequences, but not pre-microRNA. And lo and behold, they don't have these extended stems. They have, on average, much shorter stems. And so if we do our equilibrium assumptions and we form again the same mathematical operation, we learn the fitness landscape as a function of the stem free energy. And it looks again of the same type. It's a mild cliff. And so it's relatively reasonable. It says that you need a certain minimal stem length or free energy of the order of 20 kilocalorie per mole. And if the stem has this free energy or more, it's fine. If it's shorter, then this processing function is compromised, and it comes with a fitness cost. And our populations will probe this decline of the fitness landscape by mutations and genetic drift.
So can you say again, what is your background set? Do you select things that make stems of a certain length, or you
fold
mRNAs?
The background thing is we use, we tried several background regimes. They all have shorter stems. So here we use other RNA coding sequences in the Taliana genome, which, however, are not pre-microRNAs. So there is
non-coding RNAs, but they're also coding.
They're also coding RNAs. And so we just wanted to have sort of the fairest comparison of something that is the sort of RNA coding sequence, but doesn't have this processing functions that the pre-microRNA has. We can debate what this is. You get in all our choices, we had always examples where there, of course, RNAs have a bunch of stems and bubbles, but you find it's much harder to find extended stems than is this specific set of pre-microRNAs that we contrasted this with.
Right. I mean, the reason I'm asking is that people, in the days when you didn't have deep sequencing, there were quite a number of people that were trying to develop algorithms to detect microRNAs. But just going through the genome, folding pieces of genome, looking at stems, then building models and machine learning models of what are the properties of stems that Drosha does cut out, and what are the properties of stems that Drosha leaves alone, right? And there I know in the background, I mean, obviously Drosha wants to sit over a stem loop of a certain length. So anything that is too short is already out per definition. I thought the question is more, given that you're long enough, there are some extra rules that say you have to be pretty straight. In this case.
There may be certainly extra rules. But here, so what I think your question refers more to what we take as a Q set. So as a Q set, we take here this a set of 130 verified microRNAs. So there's no prediction on this positive set. So it's just a question how we most fairly evaluate this overrepresentation of long stems in the actual set. And even in this actual set, there are some which have shorter stems. So they act as pre-microRNAs, but they don't have quite as long a stem as you would expect. So this is just sort of the... now, of course, there may be errors in this verified set and so on. But so this is what you get as this distribution. And the net message is they are, on average, fairly longer than in this null set. This is just what you're saying, if this is needed for this processing function. But both of these sets have a fairly broad distribution of free energies and also of lengths. So instead of free energy, one can also take length as a phenotype for this stem, and you would get basically the same thing.
I guess a related question would be, why is it good to assume that the fitness only depends on this gene or equivalent?
It's not good to assume that.
In the regulatory element case, I can sort of see that the binding energy pretty much determines.
Right, you're completely right.
It's not clear to me. I mean, somehow one has to evaluate how good the stem is.
It's known that it's not. I mean, it's right. Known that asymmetric bubbles, for example, are bad.
Right.
So things that make, even if you have a very good, if you have a very good stem, if it has an asymmetric bubble that makes this thing bad, apparently Russia doesn't like that.
Yes. So we can do that. We can look. We can take this same machinery, and we did it to some extent, to learn whether additional phenotypes. A, we can learn what is the best definition of stem. So we could, for example, we varied systematically the kind of bubbles within that stem that we admit, and we find, like with a if we cut off with two small bubbles, then our stems will get too small, so we get too many false negatives. If we admit two complex bubbles, we get false positives. We can learn for which choices of this phenotype, of the details of this phenotype, the overrepresentation of the blue versus the green ensemble is the biggest. So to some extent, we can learn parts, at least, of what we should define as a phenotype. We could also say, let's assume that free energy is not the only phenotype. Let's look for a secondary phenotype. For example, some kind of bulginess characteristics of this stem. And let's look whether for this secondary phenotype, we also find an overrepresentation in the actual ensemble or not. So we can try to learn part of these phenotypes, but it's gonna, the explicit modeling is going to be limited to a few basic of these phenotypes. This comes, I think, close to the discussion we had in Dan's last talk on whether we have sort of unknown phenotypes as a function of which to quantify this, or whether we have a biophysical model, which usually we have only a few axes and we may miss part of the phenotypic fitness space. We're nearly sure to miss part of the phenotypic fitness space. So, and we can do the same sanity check. We can look for cross-species evolution. So we can map a good part of these pre-microRNA sequences to neighboring genotypes and to neighboring genomes. In this case, other Arabidopsis genomes, Lyrata, for example, and then we can compare the rate of substitutions in this fitness landscape. So of course, this rate depends on the selection coefficient. So if I move up on this fitness landscape, I expect to see these substitutions at a higher rate, and if I move down, I expect to see them at a lower rate, and they are in remarkable agreement with the actual frequency of substitutions that you see. So that's the same sanity check that we did for the binding site.
So
the landscapes.
What are the units here in the selection coefficient?
Well, the units in this kind of game are always, because they stem from counting, so they're always, these units are always NS. So they are in units of the inverse effective population size. So this means that you can go down, so they are moderate, so you can go down somewhat from the maximum.
Why are all of them at integer values?
This is because we bind them that way.
So I understand for this and the other one that all these are all experimentally based, I guess, but were they originally selected because of some sort of phylogenetic footprinting and then later experimentally confirmed?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Say the Arabidopsis microRNAs. I was working in Dave Bartel's lab at the time that the work was going on. And yeah, it was computational prediction first and then usually northerns to their
thought. So I guess that bias is this in the extreme.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't paid attention.
Which is that any cross species changes you do see are ones that you actually infer to be bad in the beginning. Is that right?
Well, no, you see changes also towards like longer. So you see changes towards longer stems and changes towards shorter stems. So
gear base, I don't remember now precisely, but I think gear base has some sort of a rule that says, you know, if you predicted a microRNA and you detected it, the sequencing, you still need to find an autologous stem in the related genome.
Yeah.
For you to believe it. But the stem doesn't have to be precisely the same. They have some rule, right, for saying this looks readable or not.
So there may be some bias in our primary Arabidopsis data set. We did not, so in Lirata, we just mapped these Arabidopsis. We just looked for the orthologs of these Arabidopsis pre-microRNA sequences. And we could find them for a good part of them, not for all of them. And then for the ones where we could find an orthology, we did this mapping, and this is the way it worked. So now, however, there is a difference to the previous example. And this is maybe the most interesting part of the discussion, because we were discussing the same thing in Dan's talk. So the populations, we can't think of them any longer as a point. And not because the point mutation rates are so high. So Arabidopsis is not a virus and not a bacterium. So per site, they are rather low. But the stem has a length of 10 or 15 base pairs. And we know that RNA structures are something that is a very soft thing. So you make a mutation here, it may screw up the whole fold and has, of course, an influence on the stem, on its length, on its phenotype, and on its fitness. So there is quite a mutational target for this phenotype a priori. A priori, since because of this RNA, secondary structure and the mutual dependencies, this target is even bigger than you would like to for biological function, because you can make many mutations that change the whole fold and change that stem. So mu times n is small, but mu times n multiplied by the relevant genomic length for this moderately complex phenotype, or moderately more complex phenotype than for the binding sites, can no longer be assumed to be small compared to 1. And indeed, so what? One way of thinking about this, and it's certainly an approximate way, and it, from what I'm going to tell you, it's clear that we ignore many of the sort of epistatic complexities. But one way of thinking is that you have a population. Now, if you, for example, now take many individuals in this population, so you form a sequence alignment, it's still so that in most of the positions of the sequence, you have a clear majority letter. OK? because most polymorphisms are at low frequency. So we can use the consensus genome as a sort of center point for this population. That is our reference point by which we move on this fitness landscape. And we can say that the population probes the mostly part of the nearest neighbors of this consensus genotypes. So in some sense, we are in between a point-like object on this fitness landscape and the other limit, which is a quasi-species. If we are at mu n much larger than 1, then we know that mutations have a much stronger effect, and we probe several error classes around, say, a master genome. So here, it's just sort of the tiny beginnings of a quasi-species. We probe part of this first error class. And
Michael, but we have no clue what is M for plants, let alone for bacteria, let alone plants. Right?
We don't, but we only need theta, like mu times N. And this can be estimated from genomic data, and it's of order 1%. So if you multiply this with a number of order,
you have kind of independent mu times N, and all that's why some relatively small factor, you know, at best it's 10 or 20 or 100. Yeah. Of L would matter for you.
Exactly. So if, I should have said this. Mu times N is of order 1%. So with this sequencing studies of Arabidopsis, this has been recently evaluated better. And then if I multiply this with something of order 50 or 100, which is sort of the relevant complexity here, well, then I get something which is of order 1.
We should get rid of this N and just put the coalescence time there.
Fair.
N is such a no meaning there. That
yeah, no. But as I said, what we need is only sort of a theta.
Yeah, you need theta, and
I do this. I think I do this here, right? I change notation already to hopefully to your satisfaction. Yeah, but true. That's completely. Let's try to think what happens now with this population that moves as this little cloud. Centered around its consensus genotype on this fitness landscape. So what is different from this object moving on a fitness landscape that is fairly similar to what we discussed in the previous example to a point-like object moving? So the way how we approach this, and it's certainly one way of approximating this problem, and it seems to be useful in this case. It's certainly not going to be a universal way of describing all extended populations or non-point-like populations. So the way we approached this was we said, okay, we treat so this fitness landscape, we have one term that is so A is this consensus genotype. And so if it were only the point-like object, then it would be the structure that we had in the previous example. This genotype determines the phenotype, which in this case is our free energy, as a function of which we parameterize this simple cliff. And then the fitness is a function, and this was the cliff function. And now we do a kind of perturbation theory around this. We have a correction term to this that is theta times L times, well, all the single nucleotide excursion of this population, and we decided to treat them in mean field. So we approximate the contribution by what you could call, but of course this is a little bit of loose talking because this is not a continuous space, what you could call the local curvature of the fitness landscape. And what I mean by this is simply the fitness of this consensus genotypes minus the average fitness of all these nearest neighbors. So this sample of low-frequency polymorphism, we just describe by the average of the fitness values of the nearest neighbors minus the fitness value at the center point. Let's see where this approximation gets us, and we can discuss the many things that this approximation omits.
What was this G?
G was this free energy phenotype. Right? This was the one that we projected this onto. But now, of course, you realize immediately it's no longer a fitness of this phenotype. So the simple projection from genotype to phenotype fails because this curvature here is no longer a scalar under that projection, if you will.
But why you get this expansion?
I'm not sure if it should be obvious. I was trying to portray this as one possible approximation, whether this is so. In a sense, so we have like the consensus genotype, and then individual members of this population. So that you have all these low-frequency polymorphisms. So there will be some individuals, a minority at position 5, that have another letter, another minority at position 7 have another letter. So actually, if you look at in the space of genotypes, most individuals do not have the consensus genotype, right? Because consensus would be having the majority letter at all positions. But it's different groups of individuals that branch off from this consensus phenotype at different positions of the sequence. And we decided to say and to take the average effect of, or the some kind of the combined effect of these low-frequency polymorphisms, we add them all up and treat them in mean field. So we replace this actual sampling of the first error class by the curvature times the net population of this first error class. Certainly, there's a lot of things that is neglected in this approximation, but we can ask where it gets it. There's one way of approximating this little cloud around the center of mass.
How different would the C be if, so you computed from the observed polymorphism, right? So the polymorphism data that you have.
Yeah.
But now if you make the single point mutation like by hand and compute the fitness of all the sequences that you can make, so how different is this curvature from the observed data?
So we did something like this. Let me come back to this in the next slide.
But using this curvature here also assumes that sort of bad mutations are as frequent as good mutations. Otherwise, you would get the first order term there, would you?
Well, I mean, this is whether whether on this hypercube you call this first or second order. This is a matter you could, if you will, could also call this a gradient. So it's really just what it is, literally, right? So so two things. It's operationally clear, right? So when we have these Arabidopsis sequences, we can always decide what the majority genotype is, because the number of loci where I have a high frequency polymorphism, that is low. That occasionally exists, but that's not the standard case. So the standard case is that at most genomic positions there is 38 out of 40 sampled individuals have an A and 2 have a C, so we know A is the majority. So this is easily to be determined from the data, and then we can make mutations. We can evaluate the fitness effect of these mutations. We can get the distribution of fitness effects of new mutations from our structures, evaluate them in our fitness landscape, and we define this exactly the same thing as in the previous example. It's a distribution with a negative mean, because most random mutations destabilize the stem. Many of them have zero effect, but of course the ones that do something to the stem on average make it shorter, not longer.
So the definition of effective fitness here means mean fitness.
No, it's the one that you're going to stick in your Q over.
This is the one that I'm going to stick in. And let me.
A well-defined question is whether this is the right expansion, yes or no, right? You can ask what is the solution of the full quality species equation, and then take the limit of.
But unfortunately, it's more complicated than the quasi-species because I have drift, right? It's exactly this middle regime where I have drift and mutations and selection. So it's neither a quasi-species nor the simple Boltzmann equilibrium that they had before. So it's a hard. So what makes the problem hard is I have on the one hand the quasi-species like probing of the neighborhood. So I have within population fluctuations. That's the ones we were discussing. That's the ones that that make the population structure complex. On the other hand, this whole cloud still has genetic drift is still strong, so that the between population fluctuations are also strong. Namely, this whole cloud moves and is not overlapping with itself in the course of evolution. In a two quasi species, then a drift would be negligible and again a stationary quasi species. So it's a hard problem. I'm not exactly sure whether there is a master way to decide what is the best approximation. So let me just, in the remaining couple of minutes, tell you what we did, and then maybe we can continue this. So, but the one thing that you can say, what does it do? So if we have a point-like mutation, then the dynamics of a point in this fitness landscape, then our fitness differences determine selection coefficients, and so these scale selection coefficients determine our hopping rates on this fitness landscape. So in that sense, the fitness landscape in a simple way determines the dynamics on it. If we have this additional term, then there is an additional selection pressure for flatness. So we get now when we form the change in fitness landscape between two consensus genotypes. So we now think that the consensus genotype changes, including its whole neighboring crowd of low frequency polymorphism, then there is a delta C AB, and so you get an additional positive selection, for example, if the neighborhood of this new point has less or weaker deleterious mutations. So one way of thinking about this is aggregate quantity of all the epistasis of this, but because you can, these are all the nearest neighbors here, and these are all the nearest neighbors here, and we just sum up in this mean field approximation all the epistatic interactions from this point to this point. Right. So
that's delta C.
Of course, also an approximation, because in the reality, the sampling is something complicated of this first error class. So, but coming back to Oscar's question, this is the dynamics of this consensus genotype. So the consensus genotype goes to flatter regions. On the other hand, the neighborhood probes the cliff. So it's not like in these golf course landscape assumed fitness landscape that people have studied that are tied to a given RNA structure. It's a landscape that is soft, so populations probe the cliff, and certainly they do not stay in one genotype. So they change genotypes, and anyway, it's only the stem phenotypes that matters for this specific function, and so the populations go partially down this soft cliff. But this is what this does.
It seems like as you move into flatter areas, you need to consider the two-point neighbors by definition.
Well, this depends on mu times n times l, how much you get in there. So this is still, I would guess in this example, this is very much limited by drift. So I would think that it's probably reasonable to assume that second nearest neighbors are a second order effect in powers of theta.
If all the single mutant neighbors are the same as the consensus, then you will immediately be probing 2-point neighbors.
You are right, but they will not be, because the population probes the sort of the ridge of this soft cliff. So on average, we find that it's surrounded by lots of neutral mutations, but a fair number of deleterious ones at each point. So that's not surprising, because you have this quantitative trait. Right? There's always many ways of making it worse. There's also many ways of making it better, but it's never so that a population is sort of far away from the cliff. I'm not sure how, I can't draw a good picture of this, But this is, of course, when you think of this quantitative trait, it's not surprising that it always feels a certain amount of deleterious mutations that can make the stem shorter. So when I take this new hopping dynamics with these effective hopping rates, then of course for this center of mass, for this consensus genotype, I get a new equilibrium, and it's still of the same form. And so, yes?
Do you have some intuition about this result? Because it's not completely obvious to me why you should stick the Boltzmann form. Because, I mean, basically, you know, instead of having a point that's kicked around some minimum, then you have a small cloud. But, right. You know, the curvature, you know, the more the curvature you have, the more likely you are to go towards the minimum, for example, the maximum of the fitness landscape. Because, right, I mean, if you have larger variance, you're more likely to evolve quickly towards the...
Right, but so what we did with this approximation was we still projected it onto an effective landscape for a point. So now we have again a point, namely this consensus genotype, and the sort of all the low frequency polymorphism we absorbed in this extra term, we have simply a different scalar function that is not the original fitness landscape, it has a additional scalar term, but since the substitution rate still in this work in this way, we still get an equilibrium with detailed balance in this modified fitness landscape.
So it's sort of a static picture, because you're just looking at the difference between two things. What I'm saying is that it would have, I'm not saying this is wrong, I'm just saying that intuitively the curvature itself would affect the dynamics, not only the equilibrium.
So it doesn't matter if two guys with high fitnesses, are they next to each other or are they far away from each other? It's not obvious to me that this sort of like thing still holds if you now take into account that everybody feels his neighborhood. That's, maybe then this neighborhood structure really forces itself onto the limit distribution in some sort of essential way.
This is true. That's why I said I'm not sure which class of problem this sort of feeding it back onto this so basically we do some kind of so this cloud is projected back onto the center of mass and absorbed into this effective mean-scape correction term, and it looks like for this problem where the fitness landscape is sort of easy and soft and the curvatures are finite and there's only one peak and so on, it makes sense. I'm perfectly prepared to discuss examples where this would be highly questionable. So I simply don't know how far this carries.
So can one interpret it such that if these maxima or these red points, whatever they are far apart, that you're basically sort of re-evaluating them with some sort of local phase-based volume.
Yeah, that's one way. That's one way of putting it.
Far enough, right? But the point is, in practice, it would move locally, actually, from one of its neighbors, right?
Well, so
I mean, that's what I don't understand. I guess this hopping that you showed in this graph is between the two red points, which are far apart. But intuitively, I would assume that it hops from A to a neighbor of A, and then. You know, I mean, it's continuous, right?
No, they're not far. These are nearest neighbors in sequence space. I just take a mutation process for the consensus. So I compare two subpopulations which have a different consensus, and each of them has its own little bunch of low-frequency polymorphisms. So in some sense, I compare the action of high-frequency polymorphisms with the low-frequency polymorphisms. The high-frequency ones that give rise to the substitutions, they cannot be treated in mean field, but I sort of, each of these, so I just project back the low-frequency polymorphisms for each center of mass back onto the center of mass into a correction term for the fitness.
A and B.
A and B are nearest neighbors here.
I guess his point is maybe that the rate at which you're going to go from A to B, right, because B is a neighbor of A, if it turns out that B is the highest fitness neighbor of all the neighbors that A has, then there might be an intrinsically really different rate as when B is not the highest fitness neighbor of A, even though that formula may come out the same. Do you understand what I mean? Is the probability that when you're probing your neighborhood, which direction you're likely to move to has to do with the relative fitnesses of this guy in the neighborhood. Right.
Yeah, but I mean, one thing to be kept in mind is that we're talking about moderate fitness differences. This is in this fitness landscape is what we have. So all I've done is I take, for example, when I have to compare, when I have a population where X, a fraction X of the individuals have genotype A, and a fraction 1 minus X have genotype B, then I know there were no further population structure, I would get a selection coefficient, which is the fitness difference F of A minus F of B, and that would determine X dot. Now all I've done is that all the further nearest neighbors of A, which are at low frequency, I've projected back on A, and all the furthest nearest neighbors of B, I've projected back on B. So now it's still a population where one minus the fraction X of the individuals has a majority or consensus genotype A, and the remainder has a genotype B. And
the question is, does it make sense to do that? And that means it's not really obvious to me too, because my intuition would say whether you're going to go from A to B, is the majority is at A, and you're sampling the neighborhood. Right, and then one of these guys in the neighborhood at some time will sort of become the dominant, right? So what is the probability one of your neighbors is going to become the dominant?
Well, I don't,
and you're saying that's only a function of, you know, this the what A's fitness is minus theta times the average of the neighbors, and then that down on B. But I think what is the fitness of the neighbors of B is actually not relevant for the probability of going from A to B. It's really how B is relative to the other neighbors of A that determines whether you're going to go from A to B.
Michael, you've lost detailed balance here, right?
No, I don't think so. In this projection, I have not lost detailed balance. That's why I could still write the simple equilibrium. So let me wrap up in 2 minutes, and we discuss this maybe as we go along.
Short question. Is always positive in your case.
Well, C is whatever, you know, whatever it comes out, as it turns out, because we are not having a strong adaptive scenario like in clonal interference. There are not so many beneficial variants. So the most of the variants of any of the found genotypes have a less successful phenotype according to this fitness landscape. So the actual curvature is, I don't know, with sine I defined it, is so that the average fitness of the neighbors is always a bit lower than the fitness of the genotype.
I propose that because the C's would break down your approximation.
Yeah, I would. That's precisely one of the scenarios where this may not be the case, right? But here we have basically equilibrium. So, or a modified equilibrium, so there's still detailed balance. So, but now, if we say, okay, at least these consensus phenotypes, and this qualitative notion is probably intuitive, even if we don't fully agree like how far this approximation goes, that the consensus phenotypes move a little bit to flatter regions of sequence space. But then the biological question is, so what's the biological consequence? Where the hell are these flatter regions of sequence space? So what do the stems do? What happens to them as a result of this modified dynamics on this fitness landscape? And that was a little bit, it came to us a little bit as a surprise, because what you find is that is something that you could call genomic modularity. So when we take the actual structures, we do random mutations, and we plot them as a function of the distance from this beginning of the stem. So how far they are away from the center of action, then we find a rapidly decreasing curve. So basically nothing beyond 15 or so, remember this is a logarithmic scale here, has a big influence on the stem. So most of the stuff that mutates here in the structure when the stem is here is completely neutral. It leaves the stem as is. It leaves the phenotype as is. It leaves the free energy as is. So the stem is quite robust on what you mutate. If we take our equilibrium ensemble at lower population size, which is this Boltzmann structure, we do not find this genomic modularity. So the additional term in this fitness landscape has had an influence on the configurations that we find. And we find stems that are have less of a mutational target. They are, of course, if you have a stem, you make a mutation in the stem. It affects the stem. But pretty soon outside, it becomes decoupled from this. This is what I mean by genomic modularity. It's really, it shrinks its mutational target to the more immediate neighborhood of the actual stem. Now, yeah, let me, so blue is the actual data. Violet is our simulations on this, in this modified fitness landscape. And red is our simulations in the fitness landscape for lower mutation rate, where monomorphic populations hop in the same fitness landscape. So this is what this additional term does. And it seems to, and it coincides with what we actually observe in these populations. So another way of saying this is that monomorphic poly, so the pleiotropy of mutations is reduced, because like we shrink our mutational target to the more immediate neighborhood, and so the remainder of this pre-microRNA is free to encode other stuff without pleiotropy, because it's more compartmentalized. And so the way we can ask, how does it do it? And so what we see is that the stems appear to become a bit shorter but more compact than, and hence sort of less accessible to outside mutations than in this comparative example. So we can see sort of in the configuration space where these regions of presumed more mutational robustness and modularity lie. So let me wrap up in 1 minute and then let's take the remainder of the question. So this is trivial. When you have this genomic modularity, then you can decrease the mutational load of these sequences. This is the consequence of this term in the Hamiltonian. And one way to see this is that the mutational load of the actual pre-microRNAs, which differ quite a bit in genomic length, is pretty independent of length, because you have, it doesn't really matter whether they get longer. There's not more of a mutational target for this stem, because it's compartmentalized. While in the comparative example of monomorphic population, would go up with length, because there is no such compartmentalization. So this is my summary slide. We've discussed how the evolution in one fitness landscape depends on other complicating parameters, like in this case, the mutation rate scaled by the relevant genomic length and a measure of genetic drift. So if you have this product is much smaller than one, it's basically hopping dynamics of a single genotype connected by substitution events. We have a equilibrium whose Boltzmann factors, whose deviation from the neutral distribution is essentially just governed by selection and drift. Then there is this intermediate ground where mutations become important. You start to probe the nearest neighbor of the consensus genotype, and you've made an attempt to cover this dynamics by an effective fitness landscape for the consensus genotype. And then there is the other extreme, where mu times n times the relevant genomic length is much larger than 1. There, populations probe the sequences in a fully non-local way. You typically have several error classes around some center of mass of the population populated. And in this regime, you can often neglect genetic drift. And so it becomes a balance only of mutation selection. So it's clear that for the theoretical treatment, of course, this middle ground is the most difficult, because it has all three of these forces intervening with each other. And the two case studies that I presented to you were the transcription back to factor binding sites, where we have this selection drift equilibrium, and the microRNA processing, where we see a couple of the additional things: a change in the phenotypes, more compact stems, genomic modularity, and as a result, mutational robustness. Thanks. So I'm taking the question.
One is, I want to say that there's probably a qualitative difference, at least between these two cases, right? And much of the selection in the case of the Arabidopsis may occur, in fact, because they have to transcribe those sequences, and they don't want to make mistakes when they transcribe. And in fact, has nothing to do with mutational exploration. I guess it's a similar explanation, maybe, in terms of wanting robustness, but the mechanism is really through transcription and not through two, is it not right, if you really want to explore differences between ULN, can you just change N? So examine, say, yeast versus C. elegans?
You can, but of course there's a big difference between changing N and changing mu. So if you change, I think sort of from a theoretical point of view, it makes most sense to change to changing N in this regime, because you have a well-defined limit at n goes to infinity. And then you say, okay, if I have a quasi-species, now I make the population finite, what happens? So here, you have a well-defined limit for fixed n and selection. So this dynamics for populations with a sufficiently low mutation rate, and then you add on mu. So simply because I chose this language of changing mu, because it's the simpler one if you come from this end. If you came from the other end, it would be more convenient to talk in terms of changing n. But of course, in the end, it's these dimensionless combinations that count. Mu times n, s divided by mu, and so on. Michael.
Related to that, the last thing you're saying, I just want to ask about these boundaries between the different regimes. And I think this is, you know, kind of related to what point Thierry was raising, which is, I mean, for instance, that rightmost regime, which you talk about as mu l n large compared to 1 in the intermediate regime, I mean, the boundaries between these regimes also depend on selective differences, presumably. And these boundaries are somehow right for strong enough selection, but say, you know, if S is small compared to mu L, then mu L N large compared to 1 is not sufficient to get you into this quasi-species.
So right, I mean,
S is setting like a time scale, essentially, and there's some sort of balance in time scales where you're sort of shifting consensus genotypes fast enough, you know, fast enough that you can sort of always treat things as one consensus genotype that's important to be in this middle regime, or?
Right. I mean, certainly my aim here was not to draw sort of the full phase diagram, which is very complicated, because it's also then, it's in particular when we talk like about fitness landscape, where we also have several selection coefficients and so on. So my aim was here merely to say that with this example, we seem to be in a ground which is neither well defined by weak mutation, strong selection. It's neither that limit, which part of the other examples were, nor is it in any reasonable way a quasi-species limit.
So have you looked at what you get when you try the limit mu ln much bigger than 1 for your curve? Because I think what you've clearly shown is that you've measured the real thing, and you've looked at the limit mu ln much smaller than one, and you clearly get more sort of mutational robustness than that limit mu ln much smaller than one would give you, which means that you've moved to the right. But precisely how far you've moved to the right, I think that's not really obvious.
Well, but we can estimate that fairly well because we know roughly, you know, we know what the typical mutation, what the differences in our polymorphic sample are. There are a couple of loci that matter for this genotype. So we get an estimate for this. So we know roughly what the mutational target is. And we know roughly about mu times n. It's certainly not much bigger than one.
No,
so
what is not obvious to me is that the curve that you get with your approximation in this intermediate regime, whether that is closer to the real, to the measured curve than the one you will get if you will go all the way to mu ln much bigger than one. So that I would be curious to know. I would be curious to know if your approximation regime actually gets you closer to the
curve. That's a good point. Actually, one should draw that curve as well into that diagram. But what I think, however, is it's fairly clear that the dynamics is quite far from a quasi-species. So, for example, when you look, fairly clear is maybe an overstatement, but you know, when you look at cross-species thing, then really there are the majority genotype changes. So it's like a substitution. It's still a substitution perturbed by low-frequency polymorphisms, but it happens so that this whole thing really changes in sequence space. So if you were looking at only one individual, it would hop across species in a way fully consistent with the substitution dynamics. It's just that the substitution of the majority genotype, say between Arabidopsis thaliana and Lyrata, is still, when you look a bit closer, then you see all the low frequency polymorphisms perturbing that. But the main event is something very much like a substitution. Now, in a quasi species, you don't have substitutions. You have this continuous interplay of all genotypes in this polymorphic, highly polymorphic state. So I agree with you. One should like just quantitatively see how far this is from the other end. That's a very good point. I think the dynamics, I have little doubt that it is somehow the quasi-species description would be quite far off. But
I agree with that. The question is whether the sort of robustness effect that you would get in the quasi-species limit is much bigger than the robustness you get. Maybe if you just probe a little bit of your neighborhood, that's already enough to give you the whole effect of
that. Right.
Good point. But you said you know sort of the limits of this approach.
Yeah.
Do you? I mean, so the question is, can it be that you are in this limit mu ln is very small, but it's already very different from mu ln being essentially zero. So when is it a singular perturbation?
Well, I mean, so we can ask the question like, how much in our actual ensemble does this sort of this extra term, like how much, how different is this effective fitness landscape from the bare fitness landscape, if you will, and so how much is the green dynamics differing from the red dynamics, and it looks to us it adds selection coefficients of order one to the other selections. Clearly subdominant to the bare fitness differences here, but it adds something that changes the hopping rates sufficiently so as to produce a new effective ensemble. So you can one.
Whether it sort of changes the hopping rates or whether it changes what survives. But the hopping rate should really be dominated by your first term, but then some of these do better than others in the long run because of the mutational load. And this is sort of resulting in some kind of a pruning of your distribution, which is sample.
Well, that's one way to look at it, but sort of I'm not sure. I don't agree with the separation of time scales that your argument seems to imply, because certainly this low frequency polymorphism, they are on shorter time, they live on shorter time scales than the substitution events. So that was part of our rationale to sort of have this dynamics on shorter time scales sort of projected back onto an effective dynamics of this center of mass. And so you can, this is one way of displaying the difference. So the difference is finite, as it should be. But it's just so we get typically, or another way of answering your question would be to say, what is the how much does the mean population fitness differ from the fitness of this consensus phenotype? And it's also something in reduced units of order one. So, which makes sense, because all these fitness differences here, this is a soft fitness landscape. There are no hard cliffs that would keep the population up in a confined space. So, so it probes things of order one and just reaches out a bit lower on this by its first neighbors on this cliff.
Dumb question time. You have one consensus sequence for everything, or do you update the consensus?
Well, the consensus sequence, I mean, for an actual pre-microRNA, we take a polymorphic sequence sample, and then it's in most cases clearly defined, because most polymorphisms are low frequency. So if at position 25 we have 38 A's and 2 C's, then we call A the consensus, but of course there could be. And there rarely are high-frequency polymorphisms where really 50-50. That's sort of a substitution in action. So should we defer the rest to dinner? Thank you.